us are intimate, and we'll be together after this is all over. I fly to Pyongyang on the last flight this evening, where I will be picked up by her personal security detail. Rest assured, gentlemen, our intelligence is as good as it gets. Park shrugged, and Duncan nodded his acknowledgement of the new information. Kensington was excited about accomplishing this mission for more reasons than changing the balance of power in the world. Duncan thought to himself, if this guy's sleeping with Kim's sister or aunt or one of his female advisors, he's as close as any operative has ever been to the dictators of North Korea. Chapter 35. November 13th. Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. Yesterday, the last of the dirt was pushed on top of the Armstrongs' new underground bunker. One of the ranch hands maneuvered their bobcat around the 6-inch square barn poles that had been set in cement. Stacks of lumber, roofing material, and paint awaited the completion of the dirt moving. Cooper slapped his dad on the back. Daddy, you'd never know it was there except for the air vent sticking up through the ground. And the hatch, of course. I agree, Coop, said Major, who then pointed toward the air vent sticking up through the ground. Do you notice how I've positioned those to come up in between the barn supports? Yeah. Do you plan on building around them? Exactly. This setup is relatively impenetrable, but why make it easy on someone who's trying to attack us? I plan on extending that metal ductwork through the walls of the barn and cover them up on the inside as well. I doubt anyone would notice them protruding through the roof. What about the hatch? Asked Cooper. It will be in one of the horse stalls, probably dedicated to a pony. We'll cover it with hay, and once we're inside, a pony will replace the hay by pushing it around with his hooves. It's just another form of concealment. Lucy and Palmer emerged from the house and joined the guys. Riley had taken the new Daniel defense rifle out for a test drive. On the eastern edge of the Armstrong Ranch, a ravine opened up as the plateau began to break up slightly. It was the ideal place to practice shooting targets from both short and long distances. Major impressed upon the kids to keep their shooting outside the ravine to a minimum. Even though they were isolated, sound carried, and he didn't want any passers-by thinking they were running a gunnery range. "Did you guys go inside to see what Palmer and I accomplished?" asked Lucy, as she grabbed her husband around the waist. The bobcat was parked, and a crew of a dozen men began to bang on the boards. Within minutes, the pre-cut Texas red oak planks were creating walls on both sides of the barn structure. Not yet, replied Major. You want to give us the nickel tour? Palmer led the way and groaned as she lifted the heavy steel hatch. A rush of new home-smelling air hit them as they climbed down the metal stairs to the bottom. We tried to stock the shelter with 2 weeks for starters because we weren't sure how much room we'd have, started Lucy. She walked over to a control panel and started the generator, which was in a separate underground container, complete with its own air intake and exhaust system. The generator was a tri-fuel model, which used propane, natural gas, and solar power. The propane tanks were behind the house, and the solar panels were to be installed on the roof of the barn. A natural gas well was 200 feet away, but a trench was created and a flex pipe attached to the well. It was then run into the bunker's hole to power the generator. This provided three fuel options to keep the power on while underground. Our meals will consist of a 2-week supply of primarily compact, non-perishable foods, continued Lacey. We also have protein, vitamin, and mineral supplements, including meal replacement shakes. I tried to focus on the dietary supplements to make up for the lost calorie intake that we're used to. Palmer added, Daddy, we've also stocked up on medical supplies, especially potassium iodide, which everyone will take in the event of a nuclear attack. Potassium iodide blocks radioactive fallout from entering the thyroid. It basically fills up the thyroid with good iodine and prevents the radioactive iodine from coming in. Whoa, sis, I'm impressed, exclaimed Cooper, who reached into a cabinet and pulled out a packet of IOSAT potassium iodide tablets. Thanks, Coop. Mama's got me hooked on this preppin' thing. Those IOSAT packets provide us 14 days of protection, more than we need from what we've read. Cooper returned the box to the cabinet, looked around, and began walking through the two interconnected structures. He found the closets and cabinets stocked full of water, food, guns, and ammo. I see that you guys have thought of everything. We haven't put in any extra clothing yet, said Lucy. Because our seasons vary greatly here, we'll rotate out winter and summer clothes in the fall and spring. Your daddy says we won't have a lot of time once we receive notice of a nuclear attack, right, dear? Most likely less than 30 minutes, Major replied. Here's the good news. Borden County is not likely to be the target of a nuclear strike. The group chuckled as he motioned for them to sit around a small dining table surrounded by an L-shaped bench seat and two folding chairs. Major continued, Even though Riley's not here, I think this is a good time to talk about what is possible. We won't have much time once we receive word of an attack. Think about how we spend our days. We're scattered all over nearly 10,000 acres. In some parts of the ranch, cell service is spotty, so we need to do some planning and even have some dry runs. Like a fire drill, right? Asked Palmer. Pretty much, replied Major. If we lived in a major city like Dallas, we'd only have about 10 minutes to get away from the blast. Here, the bigger problem is the lethal fallout of radiation, which may fall on our ranch due to the prevailing winds. But you said we wouldn't be a target, interrupted Cooper. That's true, son. However, there are major military installations to our south and west that might be targeted. Depending on the time of year, the positioning of the jet stream and wind currents, we might get dusted. Is it like dust? Asked Palmer. The most hazardous fallout particles are visible to the naked eye and resemble fine sand. That's what you have to avoid. Cooper added, Daddy, when the wind blows here in the spring and summer, you'd think we were in the desert. That's true, and so I don't put everyone in a panic. I ordered personal radiation detectors for everyone to carry in their wallets or pockets. They're more reliable than nothing, but to provide us an extra comfort level, I ordered several different types of radiation monitoring devices to help overcome false readings. Lucy added this. Here's the way we look at it. If there's a possibility of a nuclear attack, we can gather everyone up and get into the safety of the bunker. If nothing happens, we had a good practice drill and go on about our day. If there is an attack, we'll live. Well, sadly, those who are unprepared won't. Chapter 36 November 13th, Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. Are you impressed at how well the kids have taken to our plans? Asked Major, as he and Lucy headed into Midland again. They had requested KW Arms order the second AR-10 for rush delivery. Also, Major wanted to stop by Walmart and pick up some more ammunition. Their last stop was to conduct some prepper banking. Very, replied Lucy. Now I kind of regret not getting the kids more involved in the detailed plans you and I have implemented over the years. In a way, I still look at them as teenagers who were only interested in roping calves and killing rattlesnakes. I agree, but I think they're getting involved at the right time. If we pushed it on them as teens, they might have accused us of crying wolf and dismissed the whole concept of preparedness. Lucy sat quietly for a moment as they drove the final few miles into Midland. Finally, she asked the question that had been troubling her. You pay attention to the news more than I do, she began. Also, you just said they were getting involved at the right time. Dear, why do you think this is the right time? And don't you dare try to protect me, okay? Okay, deal, Major replied. You've got your woman's intuition thing. Well, man gets a feeling in his gut, you know. Of course. I've been around politics enough to know that you can't trust any of them, regardless of whether they label themselves with an R or a D. Both sides have an agenda, which would surprise the public if politicians were honest about it. Lucy chuckled and stated her feelings. I wish they'd all stay home and do nothing. We'd be better off. Major slowed for the first red light entering Midland and turned on his right blinker to head towards Walmart. I think there's a bigger problem that most people in America sense as well, but they can't quite put their fingers on it. What's that? I firmly believe our government is being run by wealthy and powerful individuals or business interests that have their power in Washington regardless of who's in charge of the White House or Congress. Some folks call it a shadow government. Sounds mysterious and conspiratorial, added Lucy. Have you been reading too many internet articles on InfoWars or by that crazy Dave Hodges guy? No, seriously. I know the difference between what's real and what's fake. Just follow me on this. Neither one of us has ever held a position in the government of Borden County, nor have we wanted to, right? Yup, thanks, but no thanks, said Lucy with a laugh. That said, though, is there any doubt I could drive up to Gale and tell any one of those county officials what I wanted, and they'd jump to give it to me, wouldn't they? Lucy sat up in her seat, nodded. Of course, you donate to their campaigns. You're the largest taxpayer and the biggest landowner by far. They should jump when you come calling. Major continued. You've made my point, although the comparison is on a much smaller scale. I've never been elected to anything. I earned a little respect as a lawman, and I've treated the folks who run the county well. But I shouldn't have any real power. Yet I do. Lucy pointed to an available parking space, and Major found his way into it. Walmart was packed with shoppers seeking early Black Friday deals and fixins for Thanksgiving. I see your point. There are people around the country who are like you, but their influence is on Washington and the people who work there. Major shut off the truck and sat there for a moment. Right. It doesn't matter who we elect. The people who control the levers of power could live in Boston or Silicon Valley or even Texas. Lucy then asked, What does all this lead you to believe? Why are you suddenly stepping up our preps? Again, it's just my gut feeling, but I get the sense somebody is pushing us toward a war with North Korea. Regardless of what the president may want, I think powerful people would benefit from a war with Kim, regardless of the consequences to all of us. Major and Lucy loaded up on more supplies for their new bunker, and each of them made separate ammunition purchases in the gun department. The rash of lone wolf terrorist attacks and random violent assaults by mentally disturbed people had raised awareness for retailers when selling large amounts of ammo to a single purchaser. For that reason, Major spread out his purchases between KW Arms, Walmart, and half a dozen online ammunition retailers. After picking up the second Daniel Defense rifle, they stopped by the bank and withdrew $9,000. Intentionally staying under the $10,000 withdrawal amount that triggered the filing by the bank of a currency transaction report with the Internal Revenue Service. The Armstrongs hadn't been audited in many years, and Major was careful not to garner their attention. Their last stop was The Vault, a statewide precious metals dealer who had recently opened a branch in Midland. Major had begun to do business with them shortly after they opened, occasionally purchasing bags of junk silver, pre-1965 dimes, quarters, and half dollars. Prior to 1965, the U.S. Treasury minted coins that contained 90% silver and only 10% copper. To save money, the U.S. Mint changed the mix, and soon coinage became a mix of aluminum and copper. Major's concern was the potential collapse of the economy in the event of a catastrophic event. If the government were to falter, the value of the dollar would plummet, creating an inflationary environment. He believed the public would turn to a barter economy, where goods and services were traded based upon their perceived values to one another. For example, Major might trade a calf for a horse, or a farm tractor for another bobcat. Over time, a fair price would be established in trading posts around the country, much like it was done in the 1800s. Many online prepping resources discussed using ammo or guns as valuable barter items. Major had laughed at length about this with Lucy one night before bed. He'd told her the last thing he was going to do was give another man a gun in trade just so he could use it to come back and kill his family someday. Major liked the concept of pre-1965 silver because it would be universally recognized as real, and its value could be easily established. The only downside, depending on the size of the purchase he planned on making, bags of silver were bulky and visible. He needed to purchase some gold as well. Major had phoned ahead to request half-ounce American Gold Eagle coins. He'd researched the options extensively and found the American Gold Eagle, the official gold bullion coin of the United States, to be the most widely circulated. He checked gold prices, and they'd dropped slightly to $1,800 an ounce, making the value of each half-ounce gold coin $900. Major took the cash inside and suggested Lucy wait in the trunk. He said it wouldn't take long. When he returned, he provided her a small Ziploc bag with 10 gold coins in it. She turned it around, and then upside down. She began to laugh. Do you want me to count it? Major, is this it? Really? He started the truck and pulled out of the parking lot. Yes, ma'am. You were holding $9,000 in your hand. Don't spend it all in one place. 10 coins. $9,000. He replied proudly, today? Yes. Tomorrow. After the end of the world as we know it, it might be worth 10 times that. Or more. What are you going to do with it? Bury it in the backyard? Miss Lucy, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what we're going to do. Let me tell you about my plans for buried survival caches around the ranch. Chapter 37. November 13th. The Taeryong River, near Kusong, North Korea. It was 10 in the evening when the men reached the bridge at the Taeryong River. They'd stuck to the road into Kusong as far as they dared before Duncan began looking for locations to hide the truck. He slowly eased the dark green Sungri farm truck off the paved road. The nearly 40-year-old garbage truck turned farm vehicle rattled and creaked as it descended a slight embankment toward a rutted trail created by farm tractors. The four-tire rear axle barely fit in the deep tracks as Duncan moved the steering wheel back and forth to avoid low-lying branches. They'd encountered no problems on their way to Kusong and commented more than once at how desolate the landscape appeared. Most rural areas of North Korea did not have power. From satellite images, it was apparent that the despotic dynasties of North Korea had done nothing to advance the living conditions of their people. When asked about the lack of power and electricity for their people, the North Korean ambassador to the United States once responded that North Koreans were a proud and resilient people whose worth was not measured by flashy lights. In their brief period within the DPRK, Duncan and Park observed sadness and despair in a world of quiet poverty. The people of North Korea existed, but they did not live. The men reaffirmed their commitment to succeeding at removing the obstacle that stood in the way of providing the people of North Korea a better life. Duncan etched a visual of the next few hundred feet into his mind and cut off the headlights to avoid detection. Shortly thereafter, Park jumped out of the truck and led Duncan deeper into the woods until he found a place to back the truck in for safekeeping. Satisfied they'd avoided curious eyes, the two men walked deeper into the woods along the path to see where it led. It eventually narrowed and became more overgrown. It was the proverbial road to nowhere, which suited their purposes perfectly. They returned to the truck, and Park began to toss the grain sacks over the sides to get to the secret compartment hidden underneath the truck bed. Duncan powered up the display on his Apple Watch to check their coordinates on the Global Positioning Satellite app. They were 4 miles northwest of the launch site, and approximately 22 miles from the extraction point on the island of Sinmi-do in the Korean Bay. His days of running the USS Jack H. Lucas with Captain Abbey would pay off in the next couple of days. "Okay, I'm there," announced Park, as he leaned over the wood rails of the truck to get Duncan's attention. Park returned to his hands and knees on the steel bed of the truck, fumbling around for the latches to open the hidden compartment. Duncan climbed into the truck bed and illuminated his watch's display. In the darkness, it worked like a floodlight. "There," said Duncan, pointing toward two rusted hex nuts near Park's feet. "See the pattern? There's three on each side." "Great," said Park, pointing toward Duncan's watch. "Does that thing turn into a wrench, too?" Duncan ignored the question and tried one of the hex nuts. With a little elbow grease, he got the rusted nuts to turn. Park tried as well, and within a minute, the compartment lid was loose, and they carefully lifted the steel plate out of the way. Using his watch to illuminate the truck bed, a space large enough to hide two adults was revealed to the men. Inside were duffel bags and a rifle case. Also included were two handgun cases and another hard plastic case that held rifle optics, a spotting scope, a GPS device, and a two-way radio set for short-range communications. "Well, it looks like the Brits hooked us up," said Park. "Let's see what's in the duffel bags." The guys simultaneously unzipped the dark, olive-drab-green duffels and peered inside. Park pulled out peasant-type clothing and a couple of rolled-up wool blankets. Duncan produced two cryovac-sealed bags containing ghillie suits. The cryovac shrink film process reduced the bulky sniper gear to a fraction of its size, making them packable in the rucksacks provided by MI6. The ghillie suit was a luxury in Duncan's eyes. For the purpose of this shoot, he'd planned on breaking apart some brush and debris and creating a hide. With each of them having a ghillie suit, which was already made up of basic camouflage materials, including loose straps of burlap, cloth, twine, and plastics made to look like twigs, their exposure to North American recon patrols would be minimized. He typically created a custom ghillie for his sniper activity. The sniper team wore heavy ghillie suits designed to obscure their position. Together with strategically placed vegetation, the suits made them nearly undetectable to the enemy and their target. Prior to deployment, the team spent a considerable amount of time customizing their ghillies. There was always the potential of spending long hours or even days in these outfits as they waited for the perfect opportunity to complete their mission. A bureaucrat's idea of a one-size-fits-all suit wasn't acceptable. Their lives depended upon comfort and concealment. With the unusual insertion for this operation, Duncan was pleased to get this one. "We've got MREs, water bladders with Katahdin water purification tabs, and compressed toilet paper," said Duncan with a laugh. Park didn't think it was funny at all. "Do you get the feeling they know something about that restaurant that we don't? I better not get the runs from that crap. I couldn't identify it. You should have left it on the plate." "You'll live," said Duncan, as he tossed Park his rucksack. The operatives quickly stuffed their extra clothing and the ghillie suits into the packs. They tucked the provided paddle holsters into their belts and checked the Colt 1911 service models used by British intelligence. The 45 caliber weapons packed a punch. They each had four magazines and another box of 50 rounds. This added a lot of weight to their rucksacks, but neither man complained. Each of the weapons had threaded barrels to allow for the supplied silencers. A suppressed weapon would allow the men to strike when needed, silently. Finally, Duncan reached for the rifle case to reveal the weapon he'd used to kill Kim Jong-un. It was the new Barrett MRAD, which stood for Multi-Role Adaptive Design. It was chambered in .338 Lapua Magnum rounds, which suited his purpose. The MRAD had a foldable stock, which made it portable and more readily concealable. Its barrel was interchangeable by simply loosening two bolts with the provided Torx wrench. With these upgrades, the Barrett sniper rifle could be changed to a serviceable battle rifle quickly. Duncan was provided one box of ammo and five fully loaded 10-round magazines. "Park, I couldn't ask for anything more except a little warmer weather," said Duncan, as a chill came over his body. There was no wind, and the night was clear, allowing for a frost to settle in over this portion of North Korea. "Well, as far as I can tell, we've got about a 4-mile hike over the river and through the woods that will surely work up a sweat for us both." "Let's pack up our gear and put everything back the way we found it," started Duncan. "I'm going to remove the distributor cap and hide it close by so nobody can run off with our truck. If they come upon it, it'll look broken down." "What about the gun cases?" asked Park. "We'll carry them for a while, hiding them in the woods as we go. I want to leave this truck without a trace of anything out of the ordinary. Let's not give them a trail straight to us, right?" "Right," agreed Park, as he hustled to cover the now empty compartment. Chapter 38. November 13th, near Kusong, North Korea. Duncan and Park donned the peasant garb provided by MI6 and smudged their faces with dirt. Park wore a set of earmuffs, and Duncan, attempting to hide his sandy blonde hair, wore a peasant cap with fur ear covers. Under close scrutiny, he'd never pass as a local. but from afar he was only slightly out of place because of his nearly 6-foot frame. Most Koreans were 5'9" tall, like Park. The men hoisted the empty duffel bags over their shoulders, which concealed their rucksacks, and the Barrett slung over Duncan's shoulder, but under his coat. Although they were hyper-aware of their surroundings, they couldn't appear to be in a battle mindset. Despite the darkness and the desolate location, the men were never certain who might be watching them. They took the path deeper into the woods. Duncan moved along the left side of the road closer to the river, and Park paralleled his movements through the edge of the forest on the right side. To the untrained eye, they looked like typical North Korean farmers walking along a path. An hour later, the outer perimeter of the Kusong military base lay ahead of them. After a review of the topography map provided by the Brits, Duncan determined they'd need to pass through the camp's perimeter fence and cut through a mountain pass to reach their proposed shooting site. He plugged the coordinates of the site into the handheld GPS device and led the way. Duncan looked behind him and then darted across the narrowing path to join his partner. "Park, we're getting close to the perimeter fence according to the GPS coordinates. If it's too tall or manned, we'll have to find a way around it to the south, but it'll cost us a lot of time." "Let's see what we run into," said Park. "We might be able to avoid the fence by using the riverbank." "I don't think breaching it is the best idea, especially if it appears to be patrolled on a regular basis." Duncan nodded and led them through the woods as the path came to an end. The clear skies allowed him the full moon to navigate by. The stars were extraordinarily bright, reminding him of the views during clear evenings at the Armstrong Ranch, where ambient light didn't distract the naked eye from the beauty of the universe. They soon reached the outer perimeter fence of Kusong's military base. The 10-foot-tall fence was roped with razor wire at the top. A quick examination of the structure revealed that this stretch of fencing was not electrified. On the inside, a well-worn 10-foot-wide path indicated it was regularly patrolled. "What do you think?" asked Duncan. Park studied the simple chain-link fence. It was stretched from post to post without regard for the terrain. "We could follow it until we find a low spot in the ground where we can slip under. Or there is the river option." "I don't like the riverbank because we'll be exposed to the other side, which runs along the highway. If they have night vision, we're toast." They made their way along the fence into the woods. Duncan carefully moved underbrush out of the way to clear the way for his partner. As they crept forward, they saw a burst of light. Duncan raised his fist into the air, and Park crashed into him in the dark.
"What?" Park whispered.
"A flash of light up ahead, 100 feet, said Duncan. The men found cover and studied the area where Duncan had seen the flash. A small red glow appeared.
"A cherry," said Park. "That's the lit end of a cigarette. You must have seen him light up."
"Yeah. And this sucks for more than one reason. Look at the gap up ahead. It's perfect to crawl through, but this guy would be all over us."
"We could wait him out," Park suggested.
"We could also take him out, but he'll be discovered missing at some point tomorrow. That'll draw too much attention." Park craned his neck to look over the underbrush.
"Is he alone?"
"Best I can tell. What are you thinking?"
"A distraction. When I was a kid, my father taught me how to throw my voice. You know, like a ventriloquist."
"Yeah, I get it," said Duncan. "How's that gonna help?"
"I practiced making animal sounds to mess with my sisters," he replied. "When they were playing in the backyard near the woods, I'd scare them by growling. I could sound like a dog, a bobcat, and even a badger."
"Seriously? A badger? Do they have badgers in North Korea?" asked Duncan.
"Probably more of them than dogs. You know what they say about Koreans eating dogs?
That's true in the North. These people are starving. I'm pretty sure a badger wouldn't let itself get caught. They're mean and ornery sons of bitches."
"Go for it," said Duncan. "If we can lure him away, we can sneak in behind him and keep working our way toward the mountain."
"All right. Get in position to cross. I'm going to make a wide arc through the woods to draw attention up a ways. Then I'll double back to join you. Worst case, better silence that sidearm. We don't want him to get around off first."
"Agreed.
Good luck, Mr. Badger," said Duncan, as he patted his partner on the shoulder. Duncan crawled on his belly to reach the low spot in the forest floor.
The gap between the dry creek bed and the bottom of the fence was just enough to crawl through. Park slipped off into the darkness, keeping a constant eye on the smoking cigarette, which provided just enough of a red glow to mark the soldier's position. Over the years, he'd continued to practice the distance effect, the technical term for throwing your voice. It required a series of inhales and exhales to take a large amount of air into his lungs. Park took several breaths to simulate the breathing pattern and to help him relax. He placed the back of his tongue against the roof of his mouth, effectively closing off his throat. Pulling his stomach in at the same time, he tightened his diaphragm to apply pressure below his lungs. Finally, he slowly exhaled, letting out a guttural groaning noise as his breath left his throat. The low-pitched rumbling sound of a badger was used as a warning to intruders near its territory, or when they were defending their young against a predator. By stretching out the exhale when he groaned, and finishing it off with an extended ah sound, the effect of the noise was to appear like it came from a distance. Park mustered all of his recollection from childhood and years of practice, and gave an Academy Award performance. The badger-like sound was one of his best, and quickly grabbed the attention of the soldier, who raised his weapon and darted away from Duncan's position after tossing his cigarette to the ground. Park knew he had to hustle back to the fence before the soldier realized it was a false alarm. Park also realized the soldier would likely be back to retrieve his still-burning cigarette, a precious commodity to a young North Korean in the military. By the time he reached the opening, Duncan had passed. Park surveyed the perimeter road one last time and shimmied under the fence. He quickly darted to the woods on the other side, where Duncan reached an outstretched hand to grab him from behind a large Korean red pine, which dominated the forests in this part of the country. "Good work," whispered Duncan. "There's a trail that leads in the general direction we want. Let's put some distance between us and the badger hunter." The guys walked heel to toe, making steady time as they traversed the forest and began a steady incline up the side of the mountain that separated the Kusong base from the surrounding farmlands to the west. The men took another 3 hours to crest the top of the ridge and begin their slow descent to the other side. By 2 in the morning, they'd found a place suitable for sleeping in their ghillie suits, which provided some warmth in the 35-degree frosty night. Chapter 39. November 14th. National Military Command Center. The Pentagon, Washington, D.C. Defense Secretary Gregg spent a few minutes with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as they entered the National Military Command Center, commonly referred to as the War Room within the Pentagon. In this command and communications center, all activities of the U.S. military are directed. Both men were en route to a briefing, but had several minutes to interact with the troops who manned the computer stations and monitored U.S. military operations worldwide. Secretary Gregg was extremely popular with the troops. He was a soldier's soldier, born and raised on a military base, and as a result, dedicated his entire life to the defense of the United States. His network of close allies stretched around the globe and through every aspect of the military. Even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff considered Secretary Montgomery Gregg a close friend and confidant. After some pleasantries were exchanged, they entered the briefing room and introduced themselves to Colonel Kimberly Sterling with the Air Force Space Command. Based at Peterson Air Force Base near Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, the U.S. Space Command coordinated a variety of satellite and cyber operations in support of the U.S. military. They were also responsible for monitoring space situational awareness via the Air Force Satellite Control Network. The AFSCN provided tracking data to the Pentagon, which helped catalog space objects and low-Earth orbit satellites launched by other countries. This briefing was suggested by AFSCN the day before, and Colonel Sterling, the head of the satellite reconnaissance team, flew to Washington to conduct it herself. Everyone took a seat, and Colonel Sterling powered up the 4-wall monitors at the end of the briefing room. Her first graphic provided a timeline of events to set the stage. On February 7, 2016, North Korea launched a satellite into orbit. NORAD tracked the missile on a southerly trajectory over the Yellow Sea and immediately determined it was not a ballistic missile threat to the U.S. mainland or its allies. An hour following the launch, North Korean officials formally proclaimed their mission a success. U.S. STRATCOM confirmed two new space objects were detected. One was confirmed to be a Kwangmyongsong-4, or KMS-4, satellite. The other object was likely the rocket's first stage, which was later detected falling harmlessly through the Earth's atmosphere over the Indian Ocean. "The so-called Super Bowl satellite," added Secretary Gregg. If I remember correctly, Kim Jong-un was so proud of the accomplishment that he orchestrated a massive fireworks display over Pyongyang to commemorate the launch. "Exactly, Mr. Secretary," said Colonel Sterling with a nod. North Korea further boasted that it could fly a nuclear-equipped satellite over any position in America with its technologically advanced navigation systems. Secretary Gregg added, "At the time, the executive director of a task force dealing with electromagnetic pulse attacks warned that North Korea may have launched a satellite-borne EMP. He warned that the DPRK was capable of placing a nuclear warhead aboard one of these satellites, which could be dropped on our heads." Originally established at the urging of Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, the EMP Commission in Congress conducted extensive research, tirelessly conducting tests, identifying risks, and performing statistical probabilities concerning the immediate and long-term impact of an EMP attack on the United States. Their findings were startling. This unpaid group of scientists, engineers, and security experts agreed. An EMP attack on America would likely result in the destruction of the nation's power grid and civil infrastructure, including dangers to nuclear facilities. The abilities of our government to function at local, state, and federal levels would be hampered or shut down altogether. The corresponding economic collapse and resulting societal unrest would ravage the country unchecked, as first responders would be overwhelmed or abandon their posts altogether to protect their own families. As General John E. Hyten, commander of U.S. STRATCOM, said, "It's more than a dangerous threat. It is a total game-changer. An event to end life as we know it. A high-altitude EMP detonation would turn off every light, burn up every kind of computer, fry every cell phone, and stop virtually every vehicle within the blast's reach. That's what an EMP does. It brings our world to a screeching halt and throws us back to the 1800s technologically for years." Despite these dire warnings over the last three decades, suggestions of the EMP Commission have gone largely ignored and opposed by the energy industry. Some federal regulators, such as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and most electric utilities have sought to maintain a status quo, which, the EMP Commission argues, leaves 90% of Americans at risk. Eventually, due to lack of additional congressional funding, the EMP Commission was abandoned in 2021 with President Billings's new budget. The Commission's paltry appropriation of under $1 million was deemed excessive. Ironically, the EMP Commission's budget fell under the overall appropriations of FERC, the very agency that pushed back against the Commission's findings. There was one statistic that remained unrefuted and was therefore cited repeatedly by the media and those who encouraged the government to take action to harden the power grid. 90% of Americans would die within 1 year of an EMP attack. Colonel Sterling continued, "As always, the U.S. and its allies in the region roundly condemned the launch. At Peterson, we immediately established tracking of the KMS-4 satellite, which we redesignated as NORAD 41332. As promised, NORAD 41332 passed over the Super Bowl in Santa Clara, California, during halftime, indicating North Korea's ability to plan and control the satellite's path. The USAF colonel tapped a few keys on her keyboard and pulled up a monitor depicting the satellite's current positioning. The split screen depicted the Earth from high Earth orbit, or approximately 22,000 miles above the planet. The left side of the screen was a closer view of the planet using a traditional map, identifying countries and major bodies of water. NORAD 41332 had just traveled over Australia, traveling toward the north and China. As you can see, in the time it took me to introduce this screen to you, the satellite has now traveled hundreds of miles and is currently over Mongolia. What is the second line to the left of Australia? Asked Secretary Gregg. Sir, the line overlaid on the map represents its projected trajectory. After NORAD 41332 passed over the Arctic, it will travel across the Western Hemisphere and eventually return to the line of trajectory indicated in the Indian Ocean just west of Australia. Thank you, Colonel. Does the projected trajectory ever deviate? Rarely, sir, she replied. After the initial launch in 2016, the trajectory remained the same until July 27, 2017, when the Iranians launched its most advanced satellite to date aboard the Simorgh rocket. This satellite carried the same technology as the North Korean KMS-4, which sent alarm bells throughout the world. Secretary Gregg stood and walked up to the monitor. NORAD 41332 had crossed over Russia and approached the Arctic Circle. Iranian state television called the rocket Phoenix, and the satellite was determined to be a near clone of the DPRK's launch of 18 months earlier. As was typical, we denounced the launch, and even claimed the rocket had suffered a catastrophic failure and blew up. That's correct, sir, interjected Colonel Sterling, as she turned on another monitor and revealed a second satellite being tracked. The Iranians, like Kim Jong-un, immediately issued threats and warnings. They said if their interests were ever violated, they'd issue a proper answer to the United States. The Iranian satellite was tracking a much westerly orbit of the Earth. As NORAD 41332 passed over Greenland, the Iranian satellite traveled in a southerly direction over Canada.
Colonel, are you suggesting that these satellites are capable of carrying nuclear warheads? Asked the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Sir, the technology was there in 2016, replied Colonel Sterling. We have now confirmed that the Iranians adjusted the trajectory of their satellite to match the geosynchronous orbit of NORAD 41332. The two have adopted an identical geostationary orbit 2,700 miles apart. Explain the difference, please, Secretary Gregg requested. Geosynchronous follows the direction of the Earth's rotation. Geostationary adds an additional element that assures a satellite returns to the same point in the sky at the same time each day.
Why is this significant? Asked the chairman of the JCS. Secretary Gregg didn't need to ask. He now understood where this briefing was going. He returned to his seat with a grim look on his face.
Sir, with the adjusted flight path, the Iranian satellite will pass over America's west coast at the precise time NORAD 41332 passes over the major population centers on our east coast. The room grew quiet at the implications of this revelation. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs asked a follow-up question.
At what altitude will they pass?
Roughly 1,000 miles above the Earth's surface, sir. The worst-case scenario for an EMP detonation would be around 250 to 300 miles above the Earth's surface. A 300-mile altitude would create an EMP impact radius of nearly 1,500 miles. The lower the detonation altitude, the smaller the radius, but the impact would be felt by all electronic devices.
Colonel, why do you think the Iranians and North Koreans have timed their trajectories in what appears to be a perfectly choreographed orbit? Asked Secretary Gregg.
Our working theory, sir, is that they want to time their satellites to be over Northern California and our population centers in the Northeast, including New York and Washington, at the same time.
A simultaneous attack would damage us from coast to coast, would it not? Asked Secretary Gregg.
Yes, sir, depending on altitude and location of the detonation.
How often does this perfect alignment occur? Asked the chairman of the JCS.
The colonel hesitated and returned to her seat. As she sat, she looked at both men directly. Every day, sir, at multiple times every single day. Secretary Gregg took a moment and closed his eyes, assessing the threat from above to America's soft underbelly below. Every day, at the given moment, the United States could be attacked from the sky without warning or ability to defend itself. He leaned back in his chair and stared toward the ceiling. Then he glanced at the monitors. The North Korean satellite, now labeled NORAD 41332, hovered ominously over St. Louis, Missouri. the heartland of America. Chapter 40. November 14th, Central Luxury Mansion, Ryongsong Residence, Pyongyang, North Korea. In the early 1980s, the Korean People's Army constructed a fortified compound to be the primary residence of then-ruler Kim Il-sung. When Kim Jong-un succeeded his father as supreme leader, he adopted the Ryongsong Residence, also referred to as the Central Luxury Mansion, as his main residence. The complex was far more than his primary residence. Above ground, the buildings were protected by numerous military units stationed with a broad array of weaponry. Multiple layers of electric fencing, minefields, and security checkpoints deterred any type of ground assault of the residence. Aerial assaults would likely fail as well. Beneath the Ryongsong residence, an underground wartime headquarters existed. The cavernous space was protected with walls reinforced by iron rods and concrete coated in lead to protect the headquarters from nuclear attack. A myriad of secured tunnels ran to an underground train station, which stretched to various points in the North Korean countryside. Pedestrian tunnels led to large houses, beautiful gardens, and man-made lakes within the secured perimeter. One of these residences, the Changyong Residence, was home to his beloved sister and new member of the Politburo, Kim Yo-jung. She had been instrumental in convincing her brother to become a man of the people by making more public appearances, from his early interaction with American NBA basketball star Dennis Rodman to frequent appearances at fairground attractions, state-run factories, and, of course, high-profile displays of North Korea's military might. He'd just completed an official state visit from the Chinese ambassador, who carried a message from Beijing. Officially, he was advised the Americans had threatened retaliation if he followed through with his scheduled missile launch the next day. Unofficially, both men agreed that the Americans were just posturing, as they always had for decades. The entire world knew that they would not undertake a first strike unless the DPRK attacked the U.S. or one of its protected allies first. Kim's sister sat in on the meeting, but remained quiet throughout. She knew her position was to remain stoic, standing by her brother in public, but capable of speaking freely to him in private. The two descended into the war room below the Ryongsong residence together and stopped in an opulent parlor to have tea before they continued with their day. He just instructed his military leaders to reach out to their back-channel liaisons in Japan and South Korea to be prepared for military drills to be conducted by the DPRK's military. These conversations routinely occurred behind the scenes to avoid his actions being mistaken for military provocation. The United States had just flown several B-1B bomber missions along the edge of North Korean waters as a show of force. Kim Jong-un was concerned because his radar units had failed to pick up the bombers until they were 100 miles away from his coastline. He went into a rage with his generals, who immediately snatched up two radar operators and hauled them to another room. The actions by the U.S. military were similar to the attempts to provoke Kim 5 years ago, when they flew multiple B-1B missions over the South Korean half of the peninsula below the 38th parallel. The veiled threats didn't stop the scheduled missile test then, nor would it stop the one scheduled for tomorrow. "Sister, they are a weak bully," started Kim, as he calmly sipped his tea and settled into a chair. He continued to gain weight, resulting in the removal of all couches from areas he frequented. He'd suffered an embarrassing moment the year before when he'd settled into a couch on the residential level and was unable to get off it without help. He continued to make his point. "Do they have nuclear weapons?" "Yes, but so do we. Unlike them, I have the courage and strength given to me by our father to use them." "Dear leader, my brother, they have much to lose," said Kim Yo-jung, referring to her brother as dear leader as a show of respect. "We may be smaller in size, but we are bigger in heart. That is why they cower at your shows of force and run away like the mice they are." "Yes, sister, you do understand. What the Americans do not understand is that we desire this confrontation. We want to prove to the world once and for all which country is mightier." "Indeed, dear leader, I know this. I also know that the only words for our comrades in Beijing and Moscow that are expected to be abided by are, don't shoot first. It is a smart political move, and only one which someone of your patience can observe. Kim Jong-un reached for an Ovomaltine biscuit cookie from a plate adjacent to his chair. He dipped it into his tea, as he'd learned to do in those 2 years in Switzerland with his sister. The brand outside of Switzerland was usually called Ovaltine, the powdery drink mix many Swiss and American kids grew up on. The Swiss division of Ovomaltine made a crunchy biscuit, which was frequently dipped in milk or hot tea. Kim Jong-un cherished the memories of Switzerland with his sister, and had ordered thousands of cases of the product to be available to him in each of his residences and workspaces. Calories, obviously, were not a consideration. Sister, we will not strike right away, unless provoked. But when we do, the world will never forget. We will cement our position in history and gain the respect of leaders that has eluded our country for decades. Kim Yo-jong sipped the hot tea and peered over her cup as her brother spoke. She smiled as she admired his spirit and resourcefulness. You deserve this, my brother. Dear leader, I know your day in the spotlight will come. Chapter 41. November 14th. Central Luxury Mansion, Ryongsong Residence, Pyongyang, North Korea. Following their tea time together, Kim Jong-un and his sister entered the war room, where his generals stood, awaiting his orders. The technology available to the DPRK was advanced, although perhaps a year or two behind that of the United States. Unit 180, Kim Jong-un's online army, consisting of 6,000 of the country's best cyber warriors, had mastered the ability to infiltrate the U.S. Departments of State and Defense for more than a decade. What they couldn't learn from hacking the Americans, they were easily capable of obtaining from its allies, Japan and South Korea. The world once laughed at the DPRK's ability to engage in cyber warfare, but all of that changed in 2014, the day of the Sony Pictures cyber intrusion. When Kim Jong-un learned of Sony Pictures' new film project, The Interview, a comedy that showed the dear leader in a bad light, Unit 180 deployed a malware known as Shamoon Wiper to erase Sony's IT infrastructure. In addition, the hackers of Unit 180, who cleverly called themselves the Guardians of Peace, or GOP, began leaking confidential emails of top Sony executives, A-list Hollywood stars, and their agents. The contents of these emails threw the media into a frenzy, and Sony demanded action be taken against the DPRK. Within the next several years, Unit 180 stole millions from banks, brought the National Health Service of Great Britain to its knees, and infiltrated the details of top-secret military planning exchanged between South Korea and the Pentagon. But their high-profile hacks paled in comparison to the amount of proprietary software and design they stole from international companies every day, including from their closest ally, China. These products and technologies were reverse-engineered by North Korean scientists and internet technology specialists before being incorporated for the benefit of the Korean People's Army. Kim's war room closely monitored the United States as it escalated its forces in the region. When the third carrier strike group entered the Sea of Japan, his generals sounded alarms, which placed their military apparatus on its highest alert. Today, the military loaded two Storm Petrel anti-ship cruise missiles on a newly placed into service Wonsan guided missile patrol boat. The vessels were ordered to patrol North Korea's east coast along the edge of its territorial waters. Wonsans were intended to be highly visible to the Americans. They would be closely monitored and hopefully distract them while Kim released his newest weapon, one that was far more stealthy than the Wonsan patrol boats. Sister? Today is a momentous one for us as well, started Kim Jong-un, as he approached his always eager group of generals, most of whom were in their 70s. Impeccably dressed, the men always awaited every word out of dear leader's mouth, and stood with pen in hand to jot down every directive. This is our greatest naval achievement, sister, the Pukuksong-1 submarine, codenamed KN-11. This underwater demon carries an advanced nuclear warhead that can reach America's west coast, Hawaii, or Guam. but I will use it to punish Seoul for their alliance with the Americans. If they attack us, we will attack Seoul as the first step in reunifying the Korean Peninsula under our rule. Dear leader, this is a magnificent achievement by you and your generals, started his sister, much to the delight of the generals, who appreciated being recognized. Her brother didn't praise his military leaders. Their father had told him it was a sign of weakness. It is a shame that reunification can't be achieved without loss of life to our distant cousins. Yes, sister, but that has been their choice, he quickly replied in a tone that shut down the conversation. This moment was about achievements, not the shortcomings of his regime's policies. He turned to his generals and gestured them to proceed. Dear leader, one of the generals began to explain, the KN-11 is diesel-powered and will therefore leave a footprint for the Americans to track as it drops to its lowest depth. To mask and confuse their devices, we will also launch 3 Sang-O-2 submarines with it in a cluster formation. Initially, it will appear as 1 or 2 vessels being launched. Then we will split into 2 groups. Once the KN-11 is at its lowest depth, we will divide into 3 distinct paths leading away from your great achievement's location. Kim Jong-un stood a little taller and smiled. He had learned the art of deterrence over the years from his father. When it was his turn to lead the regime, he'd mastered a level of political prowess to go along with his nature's military might. While the entire world was singularly focused on his nuclear proliferation, he was building a massive ground force, together with a respectable navy. With the addition of Russian technology, he transformed his air force from one using outdated MiG-21 and MiG-23 technology to the more modern and capable MiG-35Ds, a dual-seat fighter with advanced avionics and weapons systems capable of competing with any American aircraft. His father, Kim Jong-il, had sought to reunify the Korean Peninsula, a goal which would satisfy his people and establish a legacy for Kim Jong-un's regime. After his father's death in 2011, he knew the world expected this to be his goal. However short he might be in stature, Kim Jong-un's lofty goals would make him a giant among men. Chapter 42. November 14th. The Situation Room. The White House. Washington, D.C. The weight of the world weighed upon President Harmon as she sat in the end seat of the conference table at the Situation Room. The Situation Room was born out of frustration on the part of President John Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs debacle in Cuba. President Kennedy was angered by the conflicting advice and information coming into him from the various agencies that comprised the nation's Defense Department. During the Truman presidency, a bowling alley had been built on the lower level of the West Wing, but it was ordered to be removed and replaced with the Situation Room by President Kennedy. Initially, before the age of electronics, President Kennedy required at least 1 central intelligence analyst remain in the Situation Room at all times. The analysts would work a 24-hour shift and sleep on a cot during the night. Other presidents, like Nixon and Ford, never used the Situation Room. In most cases, a visit from the president was a formal undertaking, happening only on rare occasions. President George H.W. Bush, a former CIA head, would frequently call and ask if he could stop by and say hello. When there had been a foreign policy failure, such as when the shoe bomber boarded a flight on Christmas Day in 2009, the Situation Room became a forum for a tongue-lashing of top-level intelligence and national security personnel. Today it was the scene of a tense standoff between the world's major superpower and a gnat that had been flying in and out of America's ears for decades. President Harmon was joined by Chief of Staff Acton, her national security advisor, and the head of the CIA. Defense Secretary Gregg was unable to attend so that he could continue to monitor the scheduled war games with the South Koreans. "Gentlemen, how certain is your intelligence regarding this launch?" asked the president as she twirled a pen through her fingers. She continued to stare at the satellite feeds provided by the Pentagon, which focused on her carrier groups, positioning themselves in the Sea of Japan, and the missile launch site in Kusong. "This could either be a momentous occasion where our final attempts at diplomacy work, or it could be the start of World War III, Either way, I want to be in the room when it happens.
Acton looked at their CIA chief. Is the intel rock solid?
The longtime CIA director nodded.
Rock solid, sir, within a 24-hour time period. Years of intelligence have brought us to the point where we can identify with relative certainty when the missile launches will take place. Because of weather patterns across that portion of North Korea, the launch must take place either today or tomorrow. It will be sunny and 35 degrees today and tomorrow. But after that, a cold front moves through, bringing plummeting temperatures, wind, and snow for days.